I hereby introduce to you Mr. Michael Veazey.
Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, delighted to welcome you back to the show. Today we have somebody on who is really probably an overdue guest, and that is a lawyer, CJ Rosenbaum, who's the founder of Amazon Sellers Lawyer. And I really think it's high time we had a lawyer on, because I keep getting asked questions about intellectual property and liability, and I'm out of my depth. So CJ, you're a welcome guest. Thank you for coming on.
Oh, it's great. Thank you very much for having me.
Very welcome. So the first thing I'd love to ask you is the question I generally ask most guests, which is just about yourself, really. Just give us a couple of minutes to tell us where you've come from, how you came to end up specializing in a fairly niche area.
Well, I've been representing entrepreneurs as part of my law practice ever since I graduated from law school. And I guess probably roughly 7 or 8 years ago, a client, an old-time client, very successful guy, came to me, and he was investigating buying an Amazon-based business. And it took several years until he finally closed the deal. And when he closes the deal, of course, there are immediately the Amazon issues with suspensions and ASINs getting knocked out. And he calls me up, we start talking, and he needs help. And the only people that he could go to that he saw in the industry were these non-lawyer, you know, consultant type people. And this was a major business, a major seller. And the consultant that's out there who claims to have been a seller was never really a big time seller. And when he spoke to her, he found that, you know, he already knew more than she knew. So he calls me up, and he knew worlds more than I did at the time. And he tells me about it. We start working on it. And I love working with entrepreneurs. I always have. And I love that the challenge of David versus Goliath. You know, I love helping business people. And I looked at it, and I saw there were no lawyers really involved. And so I jumped in with both feet. I went from doing nothing but trying cases, you know, going from courthouse to courthouse to courthouse, to focusing on just entrepreneurs, and specifically entrepreneurs on Amazon, and have never looked back. And since that time, we've grown to now, we are 4 lawyers, 6 staff, all in New York, okay? If you hire us, your plan of action is getting written in New York by college-educated paralegals and reviewed by attorneys. And now we're expanding. We have an office now we're opening in London, in Dublin. We're trying to open an office in Mumbai. Also, we have an office open in Shenzhen, China, where we have a full-time staff out there. They do mostly our marketing and making sure the communications with our Chinese clients go smoothly. And we're probably going to expand into Guangzhou and Dongguan also. And it's just, I love helping sellers. I love getting it back online. The frustrating part to sellers, how Amazon is so erratic and they're ever changing. You know, to us, we find that interesting. We have meetings every single day to analyze what's working quickly, and also, of course, what's not working, and learning by following the trends of what's getting our clients reinstated the fastest.
Great. Okay. So that's a very impressive background. And I like the point, the fact you're pointing out that you guys have the proper legal background to be dealing with a complex issue, where some of the people offering services are probably just fighting above their weight, really, in a way that's not very helpful to the people who are in a difficult situation. So obviously you deal with the account suspension thing, which is obviously a huge thing. We'll look into that. But let's just take a sort of 50,000 foot view, as you would say, in the States. And what are the big sort of main legal risks that we're running as Amazon sellers, whether we're conscious of it or not?
Okay. The main risks, well, suspensions generally is your main risk. No one wants to be suspended. You don't want to lose your best-selling ASIN. But the suspensions themselves can be divided into really 2 categories, okay? One are the non-intellectual property suspensions. You're inauthentic, your use sold is new, your bad feedback, your late shipments. All that stuff has nothing to do with intellectual property law. I think that you should use someone who has a background in the law to address those issues. But those really are not necessarily legal issues. The other half of the suspensions have everything to do with intellectual property rights, where you have one brand complaining about you as a seller, or one brand doing a sweep of their entire listing claiming that you're violating intellectual property laws. And when it's in the U.S., the vast majority, like, you know, 95, 98% of the IP complaints, intellectual property complaints, are entirely baseless. I mean, they're just bogus complaints meant to thwart competition. And that's where, as a law firm, that's where, as an intellectual property law firm that focuses on Amazon, is where we really come into play. We reach out to the NFL, Major League Baseball, all the major brands, Samsung, Walmart, and Walmart has a whole laundry list of brands. And we stand up to them and say, hey, you know what? Your complaint is baseless and you should withdraw it, or you're going to be responsible for our clients' damages. And almost across the board, the brands withdraw their complaints.
Wow. So it's not just a question of some small private label seller taking on, it's some really major brand taking people on.
The major brands from around the world.
Okay. Very interesting. Wow. So this is what happens when you talk to an expert and you're going on. I kind of sort of had a laundry list of questions because I thought I should do. Hey, I'm talking to a lawyer, you know, I should use the time. I mean, but on the other hand, that was totally not what I was expecting at all. So the main legal risk is suspensions. Sorry.
You know, everyone hates to call their lawyer because they don't want to get charged. There's no charge right now. Ask anything you want. I love talking about this stuff because we really love what we do. So I'm happy to answer anything and everything.
Fantastic. Well, so let's back away from that. So the first thing you have been talking about is in suspensions. Is that, would you say that's the main legal risk run on Amazon, or is it more that's the area that you focus on as the area of the biggest problem?
No, that is the number one major risk on Amazon, that if you're a seller, every seller I've spoken to, or practically everyone, says they basically live in fear of receiving that suspension email. So that is the number one fear. It's not picking a bad product. It's not watching your returns. It is the risk of being suspension with no notice, and all of a sudden you're out of business and Amazon's holding your money and charging you storage fees.
Okay. So this goes to show that the reality of an interview is a conversation, not some kind of shopping list, because I'm going to have to rejig my brain. So that's so interesting, because so many people, when they're newbies, particularly, they're starting out, they're worried about financial liability. They're worried about, should they have a UK limited company? They're worried about product liability. So, okay, we should address those things, but let's plunge straight in. So for starters, people are worrying about the wrong thing by the sound of that. Is that right? Is that your experience as well?
You know, it's like any business, and I'm an entrepreneur's lawyer. It's like any business. Product liability insurance, yeah, that's really important, okay? Making sure you're doing things properly and watching the bottom line is vital. But from our experience, the number one thing new sellers, current sellers, big sellers, small-time sellers, the number one thing everybody fears is that email that you're getting suspended, and then how to address it so you get back to selling as quickly as possible.
Great. Okay, so let's address that then. So you split it very neatly into two parts. So let's look at the non-IP thing. So you gave examples of bad feedback, late shipments, so forth. Not technically speaking a legal issue, but more something to do with Amazon's internal regulations, I guess. Let's start off with if you get that horrible email, you check your account, it's not working. What is the plan of action at that point?
Okay. A plan of action, and the reason why I think that we do plans of action, even if they don't involve intellectual property rights, why we do them better, is because all a plan of action is an exercise in persuasive writing. You're trying to persuade the person at Amazon, probably in one of their India offices, either Hyderabad or Bangalore, okay, but it could be going to Costa Rica, it could be going to Ireland. You're trying to persuade that person on the other side of the computer to reinstate your selling privileges rather than ask for more information or rather than say no. So as lawyers, you know, we're trained to identify issues and write persuasively. And when it comes to writing to people in India, we also have to write concisely because they don't have a whole lot of time to look into your account. So that's what we do. But I'm happy to teach the world about the basics of a plan of action, because I think you should be able to help yourselves.
Great. Okay, well, go ahead. That sounds very good.
Here's your basic plan of action, regardless of the complaint, okay? One, you have three categories, okay? Three basic categories. One is the root cause of the problem. A root cause doesn't mean admitting to doing something wrong that you didn't do. I don't think sellers should ever admit to doing something wrong if they really did not make a mistake. The root cause can usually be something that you can do better to avoid a customer getting a product they think is inauthentic, right? Maybe it has last year's packaging. Maybe in like health and beauty, the color on the packaging has faded a bit. Maybe it got damaged in shipping. So I think as a root cause, instead of this knee-jerk reaction of admitting to something you didn't do, you really look into your account. They call it a deep dive. And you identify what you think caused this customer to have a problem, or for Amazon to have a problem with you. And that's the root cause. The second section The second section is the immediate corrective action that you took. You had a customer who was unhappy for whatever reason. And even if the complaint is bogus, okay, Amazon is still customer focused. Whatever you did immediately, you offered them a refund, you sent them another piece of another unit, maybe you sent them an extra 3 units. But what you immediately did to remedy that problem, to make that customer happy, and you should be doing this anyway because it's good business. Even if the customer is sort of pulling one over on you and they're not really upset, the product was perfect, who cares? Let them steal this much money from you by giving them a free product or a return in order to protect your account. Okay? That's good business. The third section is really what you're going to change in your business systemically. How are you going to make your business run better, run smoother, better product quality, better shipping, better packaging, so that Amazon basically never has to deal with you again? So you have your root cause, your immediate corrective action, and your long-term changes to your business. And you write it in very concise, to-the-point language. Sometimes we use a lot of bullet points. Other times we use real short, concise, persuasive sentences to convince the person at Amazon to reinstate your selling privileges.
Great. I love that. That's I love the clarity of thought, which, again, is what you'd hope for from a lawyer, really. But that the root cause, very interesting that you're saying don't admit doing something wrong if you haven't, because I've had friends with, I guess by now anyone who's been around Amazon sellers for long enough and knows people who've had their account suspended, and people will generally sort of grovel abjectly, but you're saying that's not necessary. And but really, yeah, it's understanding Amazon's viewpoint, isn't it? Yes, they're customer centric, so it kind of doesn't matter if the customer's being an idiot for the sake of a few dollars just to save your business. And also, I love the way you put it, Amazon never has to deal with you again. That's very concisely put, and that's the mentality that we've got to go in with, right?
Here's the rationale behind it. Most sellers don't know this, okay? They know if you get a suspension, you're writing to product quality or seller support, right? Seller performance, and you're writing your plan of action to them. And they either say yes or no, they ask more information. At some point, you then will move on, if you're still not reinstated, to a policy team. And they'll say hopefully yes, and you're back on. But sometimes they'll say no, not to escalate to the Jeff Bezos team. And the Bezos team is supposed to do a whole bottom-to-top reevaluation of whether you should be able to sell. And if they say yes, you're great. You go back to selling. But here's what most people don't know. If the Bezos team says no, okay, if Amazon's decision is that you cannot sell anymore, you still can take that decision right out of Amazon's hands and file for arbitration with the American Arbitration Association. Okay, so now you decide that you're making $500,000 a year or £500,000, right? Whatever you're making, and it's worth it to go to arbitration to get your account back. If you go to arbitration and you had already admitted that you did something terribly wrong in your first plan of action, it's going to come back and bite you in the behind. So if you did make the mistake, I think it's okay to admit it. How are you going to fix it? But I don't believe you should make up things and admit to things you didn't do, because you're just shooting yourself in the foot if you need to go the whole distance to an arbitration.
Interesting. And tell me, is this American Arbitration Association going to be valid for somebody who's running a UK limited company, which would be a lot of the listeners to this podcast?
If you're selling in the US and it's a US account, you go to the American Arbitration Association if you can't get reinstated amicably.
Okay.
If in the UK, if it's a UK-based account, you're stuck going to Luxembourg. It's a whole different system.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not even going to try and go there with European law, with an American lawyer. That would be crazy. But
I look really good in the wig.
Yeah, the wigs are good. I know a guy who became a QC recently. Was at Queen's Counsel, and honestly, I think the thing that pleased him most about it was wearing buckles and a wig, and you know, it just looks absolutely insane.
There's a process in place where U.S. attorneys can become barristers. So I plan on start the process this summer, and hopefully I'll be a barrister probably by the following summer. But we'll see.
Oh wow! So you get to wear the wig. Hey, well, I look forward to it.
I can use it.
Hey, I look forward to seeing you there. So back to the business in hand here, then. The very, very interesting. So the structure of the process is not kind of finally within Amazon's hands. So it's the seller central team, policy team, the Bezos team. But then So what are the sort of possible, I guess as an entrepreneur, I'm trying to skirt around asking about numbers, and I'm so British, I feel rude asking numbers, but what kind of percentages of success can you get at the sort of various stages? If you have to take it up to the Bezos team, I mean, is it like 1% chance, 10% chance of getting reinstated? What are we looking at?
You know what? I can't give you percentages. Most of our clients, and again, lawyers, at least in New York, we're not allowed to market by our percentages of success. Most of our clients are reinstated at the plan of action at that level. Okay. A certain portion of them have to go to policy teams, and then a smaller percentage go to the Bezos teams, where we're also fairly successful. But the percentages, I don't really know. The goal that we have and the goal that any seller has is to get reinstated as quickly as possible. And from what we've learned from people who work for Amazon, that first plan of action is vital. Okay, you really have to do a really great job at addressing Amazon's issues concisely and persuasively in that first plan of action. Because one, you have a better chance of getting reinstated quickly, and also that forms the basis of either their future questions or your arguments going forward as to why you should be reinstated. So I really can't stress enough that your first plan of action has to be well thought out, concise, and persuasive.
Great. That's very, very clear. And again, you've underlined is not just about the speed, which is obviously vital if you're losing out on hundreds of thousands of dollars a month, in some cases of people I know, but also because that forms the basis for the future. So whatever stupid thing you do here in the process is going to carry all the way through to the end and as you say, bite you in the behind. So that's really worth knowing. So it's no good just knocking something out under speed and just trying to be cheapskate. Makes total sense. So let's come back to the other version then. So the suspension, sort of the category two suspension, if you like, based around intellectual property stuff. Now, the great news is you were saying 95 to 98% of the complaints are really baseless. So the whole, I've had a consulting client who went through in Britain the whole thing of somebody coming up with an IP claim, which in the end is so hard to work out whether it is base, has got any base or not. And it was pretty hellish for him. So what is the correct sort of approach from the point where you get an email from Amazon saying, I can't even remember what it says, but something like you've been accused that, you know, somebody else has an intellectual property. What's the correct course of action from that point?
In that email towards the bottom, you're going to see the email address and the name of the person that made the complaint against you. Okay. And what we do is we look at the product. We look at how it was packaged. We look at the detail page and how it was listed. And invariably, we find that there's really no intellectual property right violation at all. It doesn't really exist in the law, even though Amazon accepted as a complaint, there's really no violation under U.S. IP law. So what we do is we write a letter as your attorney to the person that made the complaint, and we go through it step by step by step why there's no intellectual property violation. There's no trademark violation because our client did not take your logo and stick it on their product. There's no copyright violation because we didn't take your verbiage and cut and paste it. There's no violation with your images because the listing was already created by somebody else. So while somebody may have violated your rights by taking your picture and putting it up on Amazon, it certainly wasn't our client. And we go through it. And our first correspondence with the brand, it shows up on our law firm's letterhead, which shows that you're taking it seriously. And we explain a very kind of polite, firm way. There's no violation. And in a lot of cases, that and a couple of phone calls will get that complaint withdrawn. Other times we have to be a little bit more strenuous, a little more zealous in explaining what the company's potential liability is if they continue to refuse to take back their complaint. And what we're doing there is we're trying to persuade them to withdraw their complaint. And simultaneously, we're sort of building up arguments to then submit to Amazon that there is no IP violation. We've done everything we could to get it withdrawn. We've hired a law firm to submit to Amazon as well to try and get them to reinstate, even if the brand refuses to withdraw their complaint. So we do both simultaneously.
Okay, makes a lot of sense. So that you're looking at a situation where big brands sued you for some kind of alleged IP, look at me, I know I'm talking about a lie now, I'm using the word alleged IP allegation. So what if, and I have seen this in the UK, I haven't yet experienced it in the US personally or with my friends, it's a matter of time though, what if another, so basically white label seller who's got something that nobody's ever heard of, does a similar thing. Is your approach any different in that situation?
Well, if we're representing the brand, we're on the other side of the fence. So if you have your own private label, what we're then doing is first we look at the product and we make sure there really is an intellectual property violation. Okay. And sometimes there is and sometimes there's not. Just like the big brands have problems where their products get outside their intended distribution network, smaller brands have that too. So if there really is no violation, okay, we'll reach out, but we're not going to make an allegation of a violation if there is none. What we do, we also work with brands to develop intellectual property rights within the brand. There's a lot of ways to do that, that you can protect your brands and build some type of IP right into it.
That sounds really, really, really good news. Now, like, I'd love to come back to that, but just backtracking from that, I know that a lot of people who are listening will be, you know, scared by now, but equally, I know some of the more advanced sellers who are listening, and I know that there are a few who talk to me and say that they're listening will be getting quite relieved by the level of success you can have in getting reinstated. But let's backtrack. When it comes to IP, all the way to the beginning of the process of private labeling, which I guess you're probably familiar with now, but I don't know if you do it yourself, but that we are starting off going to China, which is famously a bit of a wild west when it comes to IP, to put it politely, right? Or another way of putting it is this kind of doesn't exist in a lot of their minds. I mean, I know it does in the Chinese legal system in theory. So how do we, and this is probably a how long is a piece of string question, what best practices should we go in with to try to minimize the chances of ending up with somebody else's intellectual property in our products?
Right. This is where the advice and the lawyering is the most important, because the best thing a lawyer can do is help you avoid problems. So whatever you're developing, your number one threat, if you're having it manufactured, it's not just China, whether it's China, Vietnam, Thailand, India, your number one threat is your own factory, okay? But you'll go in and you'll ask for 10,000 units of whatever your product is. You'll take your product. The factory will agree not to make it for anybody else, but then they do. And then they sell to other people who then start competing with you. And when that happens, there's no violation because they're selling the real deal. They're selling genuine products. So what do you do to protect yourself? In your contract with your factory owner, you want to make sure you're in a province, if you're in China, that is trying to gear up their intellectual property issues. Shenzhen, Guangzhou, okay? These are provinces where there's a battle going on in Asia as to who's going to be the leader of the intellectual property world, right? And you have Hong Kong and mainland China, right? And Shanghai and Taiwan, and they're all battling to be the next place, which means they're going to start protecting rights. So you might as well pick a fact where the courts will recognize your rights. You also want to file for trademark protection or copyright protection, not only in the U.S., you know, or U.K., but you also want to add to it, and it costs practically nothing. You want to file through what's called WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, in the countries where you're manufacturing and the countries where your biggest risk is coming from. That'll give you some protection. What we also highly suggest is that you change your contract. If you're based in the UK or you're based in the US and you make a contract with a factory that's written by a lawyer in the US or in the UK, those lawyers are writing in that if you have to go to court, you're going to go to court in the US or you're going to go to court in the UK, which makes no sense because the factory owners in China and Thailand and Vietnam and India, they don't care what a court in the US orders. They don't care what a court in the UK says because they're not going to abide by it anyway. It's never going to reach out and touch them. So what we suggest you do is you put venue where your factory is. So you bring the fight home that if you violate our agreement, I'm coming after you in your home court because that's what the factory owners care about. And so I recommend you sue somebody in Shenzhen. No, but I strongly recommend you obtain the ability to do it because they don't want you reporting to their governing bodies that they're breaking contracts or violating any intellectual property. That's where your leverage is as the idea person, as the brand owner, against your own factories. You have to bring them. You have to bring, if there is a fight, it's coming on their home court. That's what you care.
So in practical terms, this is another piece of string question, but how easy is it, or how would you recommend somebody who hasn't got big resources and isn't necessarily going to fly to China every 5 minutes because that's a pricey thing to do, to get presumably you're suggesting using a Chinese lawyer to draw up the contract?
No, I'm not.
If you're in China, you're not. Okay.
No. If you have any lawyer who can do these contracts, you know, we could do it in like an hour. Okay. So you're talking about a minimal investment.
Okay.
But that contract should say that if you have to enforce it, you're going to do it at their home court.
Okay, got you. So basically a British lawyer or American lawyer can draw up the contract, but it's the jurisdiction which applies, which legal system is applied is what they're changing.
That's right.
Interesting. And does this stick in practice? Because a contract drawn up in English, I've also heard, I spoke very briefly to an IP lawyer from Scotland, and he said, you know, it can be a little bit tricky if you have your document drawn up in British English, American English, whatever, and it's translated into Chinese. The exact meanings, of course, in law can be very important, can't they? Is that something that you would say is an issue that you should see?
It's definitely, I recognize it as an issue. We have not seen it as a problem, at least not yet. And again, I'm not recommending litigation. I'm not. You want the contract to give you negotiating leverage. That's it. You want the ability to enforce if you have to, but if you really had to go to litigation, it really should be few and far between. Litigation is not good for sellers. It's not good for business people. Litigation is usually only good for lawyers.
Yep. That is one of the givens in life, isn't it? That's certainly true. So, and no disrespect intended, but I think what you're doing is giving us a massive stick in the negotiation. So it's, this is fantastic stuff. It makes so much sense as soon as you say it. But of course, as a non-lawyer, I have no idea that these things are possible. I mean, the fact that you can draw up a contract under some form of Chinese law in America is great news to me. But so would you say, and how does it work in very brief terms? Does each Chinese province have a separate legal system and you have to go by province, or can it be China-wide?
Up until 2012, China had zero intellectual property law. It just did not exist yet. Okay? You know, our intellectual property law system dates back about 300 years to the founding of the United States, and that system is based upon your system, okay, which dates back another few hundred years. So we have a really deep set of precedent that the law is based upon. China doesn't have that. China has it all codified. I mean, it's all written like statutes, like, you know, how fast can you drive in a car? That's a written statute that limits the speed on a highway. China's law when it comes to intellectual property is all written statutes. It started in 2012. It was redrafted in 2016. One of the main differences in Chinese law is in the U.S. at least, it's a first to use. Okay. If I'm the first to use, I hope it's okay to use a picture of you. If I'm the first to use this as my logo, okay, then I own the rights to it, whether I file or not. And this is really broad statements. In China, it's a first to file, okay? So Nike may have been using their swoosh 30 or 40 years, but if they didn't file for protection first in China, someone else could potentially own the Nike swoosh in China.
Very interesting. Okay, so that gives us a very clear difference in an approach, I guess. But so backpedaling a little bit from that, so you've talked a lot about protecting your own IP, and this is really golden stuff. So a good lawyer in the US or UK, or certainly a specialist like yourselves, would be able to sort this out pretty straightforwardly by the sound of it, but gives you that stick with which to beat your factory. So hopefully you never need to go near it, and you will behave like gentlemen and everything goes well. But